There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Alonement. I'm Francesca Spector, a journalist, author, and host of this podcast. Each week, I interview people that I'm interested in, all about their time alone and what it means to them.
It isn't enough to say that you can know yourself by being alone, because there are ways of being alone that below the surface are actually ways of not being with yourself.
You can feel lonely in a room full of people, and you can feel so content completely on your own.
Whatever your age, life stage, or relationship status, we can all enjoy a bit of time by ourselves. And on this show, we discover wisdom and personal stories about how to do that. Because when alone time isn't lonely, it's alonement.
People who are able to feel seen and understood, feel enough within themselves when they're alone, are so capable of giving that to others.
A lot of the cultural discussion that we have tends to be about the adjustments that introverts need to make in order to thrive in our extroverted world. But I think it really goes both ways. I think that all of us need to learn to make adjustments, you know, to find a greater sense of balance.
Getting engaged to your partner is typically a time for celebration. But for today's guest, Max Dickens, it was more complicated. As he prepared to propose to his girlfriend, Naomi, he had an uncomfortable revelation. He couldn't think of anyone to ask to be his best man. This prompted a personal crisis for the writer and comedian, one which inspired him to address the dwindling friendship connections in his own life and to investigate the topic of male mental health and loneliness some more. The result was his brilliant non-fiction book, Billy No Mates, How I Realized Men Have a Friendship Problem. This was a wide-ranging discussion, which actually opens with a chat about the romance of solitude, something Max has always valued, but once used as an excuse for why he sometimes had no one to see at the weekends. We also cover gendered attitudes towards both solitude and loneliness, which was really interesting and definitely opened my eyes. I hope you enjoy. Before we get to the episode, I want to thank our season sponsor, Sensate. Have you always loved the idea of meditation but never quite got on with the practice? Sensate, a palm-sized infrasonic stress and anti-anxiety device, is the friend that you need. I've been practicing things like breathwork and meditation for 2 years, but integrating this little device into my daily sessions, which syncs up your choice of relaxing soundscapes from the Companion app, has helped me discover a new kind of deep relaxation. There are lots of tracks to choose from, including nature sounds for stress relief and soothing sleep rhythms. Visit getsensate.com/alonement for 10% off your first device. I'll also pop that link in the show notes. I was saying just before we came on the recording, I'm absolutely so impressed by all the podcasts that you've done around this subject. There was that really amazing joint recording that you did at IF Oxford with Robin Dunbar, the king of friendship research. So it's made my researching job very easy ahead of this podcast, listening to you speaking on all of these. But it's interesting to me because the thing that I haven't yet heard you speak about is your love of solitude. And just to sort of kick things off by reading a paragraph that really caught my eye in the book, Billy No Mates. You wrote, I've always had a romantic attachment to solitude.
Yeah, so I sound like a bit of a pain in the ass, don't I, in that? I'm someone who spends quite a lot of time by myself. If you do write, it's true of almost all creatives, so much of it is time spent by yourself. And if you look at the iconography of writing and creativity. And if you take the romantic poets, right, they're walking through the rippling green pastures of the Lake District, and they're creating these rhymes and these ideas, and they're doing it in the shadow of the clouds. And that, you know, what does Wordsworth say? Like that the inward eye that is the bliss of solitude. Like, there is this whole kind of sense that it's intimately connected to time spent by yourself. And when you are by yourself, and I am doing something creative, it does make me feel vaguely heroic, like I'm at the frontier of something, like I'm braving this thing. And there's something quite nice about that. I do think it can become an end in itself, and people forget that creativity and solitude are often linked, but they're not completely overlapping. So this kind of romantic attachment to solitude as a crutch for creativity, or as a route to spiritual enlightenment, if you look at them, I actually chatted to Robin Dunbar about this. If you look at the monastic tradition, or that idea of monks alone in spirituality, it's dominated by men. And if you compare nunneries to the male equivalent, there's a lot more men in that sort of lifestyle than there are women. Now, that might reflect preference. It might also reflect misogynistic culture. The romantic poets, the idea of men being alone is considered romantic, and how they reach out and grasp these ideas from the ether, or how their muse comes and sits on their shoulder and whispers their wonderful work to them. But with women, I suppose it's much more attached to this idea that if you are alone, it's because you've been rejected from society in some way.
Yeah, so I found that description really interesting. I mean, I don't know about you. I suspect maybe we both studied English literature at university.
I actually did a philosophy degree, so I did philosophy and politics, but I did read a biography, one of the romantic poets, and I've been to the Lake District, and I've read a biography of loneliness by an emotional historian. So I've thought about this a little bit. Yeah.
You've thought about it a little bit. Okay. I'm actually just spouting my English literature degree. You've actually done a deep dive into this, you know, sort of romanticism and loneliness, and you're really, you know, and you've done the philosophy degree. But I think coming from that, I don't know, almost cliche of the romantic poet wandering the Yorkshire moors, I remember thinking, even at the time, it is a particular image of solitude, but it's also quite a gendered one. I mean, the thing that struck me actually with your wonderful description of walking along a body of moonlit water is that as a woman, you can't really do that. You sort of almost have to take company along, even if you don't want it. But you speak about loneliness as gendered very specifically in Billy No Mates. Do you think that solitude has the same sort of gender distinction?
Yeah, I do. And if you think about Virginia Woolf, so I'm sure there's some Virginia Woolf in your English literature degree, A Room of One's Own was like finally having a space as a woman to be alone and to do creative work. So this linking of solitude with creativity, I think, is definitely gendered, because it comes from a culture where women were considered unable to do that sort of creative work. So why would they need solitude? So not only that, but also a woman by herself was considered probably to have been rejected by someone, pushed out of a family, rejected by a man, perhaps literally insane. So a lot of the semiotics of solitude for men and women is definitely gendered and misogynistic. But interestingly, I think there might be something to do with taste as well. Like, I know alonement is or have lots of listeners who are male and female, but one of the things I talked to Robin Dunbar about, and his research has looked at, is if you look at the monastic traditions, so people spending a lot of time by themselves for spiritual reasons, whether they be nuns or monks, it seems to be men who make that choice a lot more than women. Now, again, there's definitely some misogyny there, because perhaps patriarchal societies are going to be dominated, the religion would be dominated by men. But there does seem to be a group of men, maybe at the extreme of the distribution, who are more likely to make the commitment to spend a lot of time alone. But we don't all want to be monks. But the people who choose to be monks
that generally they seem historically to have been male.
And why is that? Why does it have to be so extreme? I always wonder about this. Why does masculine solitude always have to be this giant extreme thing of wandering alone on a sort of, you know, out in nature on this journey, perhaps at nighttime? And female solitude is this kind of very small domestic thing. I mean, a room of one's own to write a book or a short story, you know, as requested by Virginia Woolf, that's quite a modest ask, really, comparatively.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, very deep cultural definitions, isn't it? And yeah, I mean, do you think it's changing? I mean, maybe I'd respond to that question with another question. Do you think associations with solitude now are less gendered?
Gendered framing has changed. I mean, I think obviously what still exists is that gendered double standard around walking alone at night. I have this conversation with my brother, who's, you know, this big 6'2" bloke who, you know, he can sometimes walk home from nights out at night, and sort of he's not, you know, obviously there are also risks, but he sort of he'll do that. So that's maybe his version of solitude, whereas mine will look very, very different. Men and women are still, you know, physically different, and there's still that sort of that double standard. But I wonder if there's a preference too towards the way that it's illustrated. But you know, when I was asking the question about why it has to be so extreme as well, I wondered if there's almost like a toxic masculinity to sort of almost like having to outdo each other at this solitude. You know, it's like, oh yeah, like, you know, bro, you went on a 5-day silent retreat, I went on a 10-day silent retreat.
I mean, the competitive obsessiveness of a lot of these masculine norms is probably part of it. I mean, something I thought of when you were speaking there was this thing now called monk mode. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's like sort of like this productivity thing where I got to get rid of everyone from my life because I'm just going to get in the bunker and I'm just going to code and I'm just going to get on it. I'm going to create my business. I'm going to do 1,000 pull-ups a day. And that is definitely in that sort of genre of slightly toxic male excessiveness, which goes beyond being functional and becomes pathological. Because I think solitude, most people would agree, it's part of a well-lived life. Some people want more of it than others, but there's a good function to solitude. But if it becomes just an end in itself, it often that is to prove a point, and that is probably a bit pathological.
Yeah, yeah, it's so funny. You mentioned monk mode. I was living in Lisbon a little earlier this year, and I had my neighbour in the flat where I was staying. My neighbour was in monk mode. He just started a crypto startup, and everything. He was also like very spent a lot of time at the gym, very 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 hench. That was the exception. That was his sort of social allowance, going to the gym.
He didn't talk to anyone. He just went around with his earpods in, listening to 4-hour long Joe Rogan podcasts.
Absolutely. I don't quite know if the Joe Rogan thing is correct, but I'd bet some euros on it. So I'll put it that way. He's doing that in Lisbon as we speak. But you know, it was, I don't know. I at the time, I guess I was in two minds. I guess I thought, okay, if you can do that, that's something that I don't quite understand, but maybe that's a greater degree of introversion. But what I, you know, that, you know, that I don't quite relate to, but what I was maybe concerned about is that was the only way that solitude seemed okay. And that it had to be, as you say, that sort of, you know, that macho competitive thing. And also I suppose when these things come out, you know, when something like monk mode gets normalized, and that is very much, I mean, you know, that's a masculine trope, right? I don't think women, there's any kind of monk mode female TikTokers that I'm aware of, but I wonder if that's then helpful at all, because, you know, or actually becomes like an unhelpful glorification of solitude. I mean, and this sort of touches on, you spoke about how this romantic attachment to solitude, on the one hand, you appreciate me time, and I'm sure that's something that you still feel. You sort of mentioned just now about that balance, but also that you were using it almost as like a justification for sort of not going out as much, not socializing as much?
Yeah. So when I was spending a lot of time by myself, I would sort of rationalize it by going, this is part of the path of someone trying to do serious work, someone trying to produce a piece of writing or to create a story. This is what great writers do. Or this is what people who achieve things do. They make sacrifices. And one of the things they sacrifice is social connection and social time. And it wasn't, you know, all the time these thoughts churning in my head, but it was just enough to rationalize going, oh, it's another weekend where I haven't seen anyone or hung out with anyone or made a plan. But it's all right because I'm trying to do something more important. I'm trying to do ABC. And I think that is what I was getting at.
Yeah, that makes sense how that was sort of rationalized. Because you say you were busy, you were spending time with your sort of girlfriend, now wife's friends quite a lot. You know, you had your colleagues, you had a lot of sort of social interaction, but it was just feeling that what you refer to actually as weekend loneliness. And I think we'll maybe get onto that term a little bit later on, because I think that was a really interesting phenomenon that you explored.
I think it may be useful here for me just to clarify that. So loneliness and solitude are obviously not the same thing. So solitude, I'm sure people have slightly personal definitions, but solitude might be time you choose to spend by yourself. And loneliness is a subjective feeling of being unhappy with your social connections. So they're not, you can have a lot of time in solitude and still not feel lonely. Some people can have almost no time in solitude and feel lonely, right? So they might have loads of connections and feel lonely and vice versa. So it's very much a subjective thing. And so a lot of people, when I talk about friendship, which again is its own slightly different category, like friendship, famously hard to define. Clearly there's a link between the number of friends you've got and do you feel lonely or not? But people would often say to me when I would talk about this and I go and do speeches or I speak to folks like yourself or write bits and bobs, they go, well, hang on. You know, I don't have that many friends. I'm quite happy with it. I quite like spending time by myself. And you're telling me I need to see loads of people. But I'm saying, no, I'm not saying this at all. I'm saying that solitude can be very healthy and different people have a different appetite for it. But it needs to be part of a mix of things, a mix of different relationships. And it sits in that kind of biome. And a really interesting analogy here, I think, is from a guy called Jeffrey Hall, who's a professor from the University of Kansas. He talks about our social world is a bit like our gut. So the gut biome, different bacteria all exist in balance. Same in our social world. We need to have some close relationships. We need to have some more casual ones, like with work co-workers, for example. We need to have a bit of small talk, like we might have at the barista. We also need some moments alone and some solitude. They provide different roles and they need to exist in a balance. So it's not about getting rid of solitude. It's not about only having close friendships. It's about understanding that it's a balance and that social health, like gut health, is maintaining that balance. And I had reflected at the start of my journey of writing this book, it got way out of balance for me. There was probably too much time in solitude and not enough time socializing, and especially not enough time with these close connected friendships, intimate friendships, which therefore made me feel lonely.
You know, I haven't heard that analogy before of sort of social biome. I like it because I think that it's a good way to think in that more nuanced way that we really need to about this topic and connections. You know, it really isn't as probably simplistic as most people tell you growing up. You know, growing up, you're like, oh, just like, you know, go hang out with your mates, you know, go. And actually, I think, be around people, book out your calendar. And I think that actually when you get to a crisis point and you realize that the balance is off is when you really have to then come back and explore that nuance. So for those who aren't familiar with the book and sort of your background, why was it that at this time your social biome was off?
Well, I mean, it came from a sort of a wake-up call where I was planning on proposing to my girlfriend, went as far as shopping for a ring to make the proposal. And then the subject came up, you know, who are you going to have as best man? When I'd gone and shopped for this ring with two two female friends and they said, right, well, you've got the ring, you've got to do the proposal and you're going to eventually choose a best man. So who are you thinking? Because it's quite this big idea with guys, right? It's, who's that person going to be? And I couldn't think of anyone. And I made a list. It took me ages. Like, it didn't come to me easily, which was the first sign something was up. And then when I looked down the list, I worked with half of these people and I like them, but I think they'd be a bit surprised, should we say, maybe a bit weirded out, one or two of them. I said, hey, do you want to be my best man? And the rest of the list, I hadn't spoken to some of these guys for 2-3 years. And I just thought, oh, when I was in my mid-20s, I had loads of male friends. Now, where have they all gone? And when I looked into the challenge, I realized that men have a friendship problem since the 70s, where they started measuring this stuff. Survey after survey after survey shows the same thing. Men have less friends than women, and they have less close friends, especially. And as we get older, the problem tends to compound and get worse. And if you look at older men, but especially men at pinch points like divorce, bereavement, retirement, that's when male loneliness is a real challenge, because they suffer worse mental and physical health outcomes. And it's kind of set me off on a journey to try and work out, why is this? What can we do about it? And obviously for myself, I wanted to find a best man. So the book is me writing about that experience, talking to all the experts, sharing a load of personal stuff, packing it full of jokes so that guys that might not want to buy a book like that can be like, oh, I will laugh on every page. I found some interesting answers.
It's almost like a Trojan horse approach to writing a book about loneliness effectively, because you spoke earlier that you know about the reading that you've done, that you've read, you know, guides to loneliness from a sort of, you know, big, weighty philosophical tome.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Perspective. But you knew that actually if this were to get to the audience that you wanted it to, you needed to dress it up in comedy. And you of course are, your background is also in comedy, right?
Yeah. So my background is in professional radio and stand-up comedy. So I tend to work with humor and with jokes as the medium. And I think if you write about men and talk about men, you've got to be careful with the tone, because conversations around masculinity can become wallpaper. It's so ubiquitous that I think a lot of guys just tune out of it, and they want to be bought into it with a narrative, and they want to be bought into it, I think, with a sense that they can relate to the storyteller. I just front up and go, this is all the things that were going wrong, and here's what I tried. I look very silly all the way through. The joke's always on me. And then vicariously, guys hopefully can reflect on themselves. Because I think friendship and relationships and solitude as well, because it's connected, is a great way of reflecting on gender, full stop, because gender shows up so profoundly in all these things. So I found like conversations around masculinity, we've used the phrase already, toxic masculinity. I don't love that phrase, but I think it's unhelpful. I think maybe initially it was useful because it refers to certain traits of traditional or hyper masculinity, which can become unhealthy for women and for men. So that's what the original function. I know what the definition is, but like with most words that get used a lot, the definition becomes baggier and baggier, becomes unhelpful because it's sort of used as a way of not quite thinking through the things that it's being used to describe or to try and diagnose. I also think if you want to buy men into these conversations, using that word is probably, they're either going to think they've heard it before and just tune out, or they're going to find like it's inherently critical, and often the criticism is fair, but I just don't think it's going to buy them into the conversation as much. So I tried to avoid using the phrase, but also not let men off the hook, because I didn't realize how I'd learned masculinity or how I went about being a bloke, because it was not that idea of gender being a performance and things we get socialized into and learn was too abstract for me. And it felt a bit, I don't know, new age a bit. That sounds absurd now, but for me, as I said, I wasn't in that world. But then when I remember my girlfriend saying, came back from a party and she said, do you know what you like around men? Like, do you even like men? Because you become this completely different person. Like, you're nothing like you are with me, with them. Do you realize that? And I was like, oh man. And it's because when I'm with blokes, I step into a completely different performance, and masculinity is not just in me, it's between men. Ultimately, it's between men. And then I started going like, oh, this applies to other areas of my life. This applies to why, you know, I can't have a sincere conversation with pretty much anyone. Why I always dress to kind of be invisible. Like, it kind of blew open my whole experience of my world. But the kind of door into it had to be something super practical. And then I was like, oh, yeah, I now understand what people mean when they talk about masculinity. And I think that's kind of what you use the phrase Trojan horse, and that's kind of exactly what it was, is and almost accidentally, because I generally didn't go into it wanting to write a book about necessarily masculinity. I just wanted to write an entertaining answer to the question, but it became that. And I thought it's a useful way of getting blokes to see themselves a bit differently.
Okay, so let me just get through the amount of Trojan horses we have here. We have it's a book about loneliness, and the Trojan horse that is comedy, and then but actually it's about masculinity, and we've got various. I almost feel crass using this term, but like, it's an incredibly fun book. It's an incredibly readable book. It's an incredibly it is a story. It's a narrative. It's not the kind of thing that, you know, I think you would be reading if you were like, right, I want, you know, the five top tips about you know, making friends as a man. It's the kind, you know, you actually sit there and you do engage with it emotionally. So, you know, I think that writing was so successful in the way that you've done it.
Thank you. And I get messages, and like, you know, messages on Instagram. Got a couple this week and I love getting them. But, you know, blokes telling me like they read it and they started crying. But they also were saying, I found it really funny, but I started crying. So you're right. Like, it's not like a self-help kind of, here's 10 bullet points, how to go and make loads of friends. Because I think fundamentally, if you are going to have really good relationships with other people, you've got to have a better relationship with yourself. And that starts with a degree of reflection and understanding who you are. And that's so much about what gender is about. It's going, who am I? How am I masking that in how I show up and perform my gender to other people? And is that healthy or not? If I go and do talks or go and do interviews, I can do the top tips thing as well, but I think hopefully the experience of reading the book is much more immersive in going, oh yeah, if I can't have an intimate relationship with someone, what does that say about me? And how have I become like this? Because you look at 4 and 5 year old boys, 4 and 5 year old girls in the playground, talk to social psychologists, you can't tell them apart. They behave exactly the same way. They're connecting in the same way. You know, they're showing emotions, they're crying, they're laughing, they're hugging, they're holding hands. And you look at 18, 19-year-old boys, 31, 32-year-old men, it's like, what's happened? And there is a story behind that.
It's gendered conditioning. What were the sort of gendered behaviours getting in the way of your connections with men, with the ones that, you know, you kind of thought of as your friends but actually realised weren't quite the intimate relationships that you wanted?
I mean, there's a few kind of unspoken rules I would bring. I mean, one really simple one, which I think a lot of guys will relate to, is the context in which we hang out with friends often get in the way. So I've got, luckily, I'm glad to say, lots of female friends. And the breadth of what I can do with female friends is so wide. Like, they might be like, let's go ice skating. Let's go and have a cocktail. Let's go for a walk and then get an ice cream or whatever. With male friends, it's like, what pub are we going to? And you wouldn't even really go and have dinner with a guy. Maybe as I get a bit older, that's a bit more common. We might eat together, but we go and get food, having been to the pub. Like, should we go and get some food? It's never like, hey, let's all go out. And if we get food, it's generally like quite food, you know,
bro,
like
food.
It's a curry or it's a burger. It's not like, you know, anything too delicate or sophisticated. So the context is a big thing. What context are you meeting one-on-one or in groups? Are you meeting in a place that's dominated by booze? So there's that. But other rules were this kind of idea that it should be fun. And obviously, we want our social relationships to be fun quite a lot, at least at times, because they should be enjoyable. But for blokes, it's not just fun. It's like funny. And it's, you know, you might talk about it, the culture of banter. And so the quite a quite a specific way men relate to each other. It's like, you know, when you see it, you can hear it. It's like this, I call it this jazz of casual brutality. We're always in at each other. And that can be fun. It can be part of the kind of the vibe, but it blocks us off. Because what do you do if you're in that environment? You come in with a moat around you, so people can't quite get close enough. Or you come in wearing armor, so it bounces off. There's certain sides of yourself you won't show. And I think it's also this sense that your conversations and who you are has to be permanently filtered through a tone of irony. Like, sincerity is almost breaking the rules, and it makes people uncomfortable. Like, blokes don't give each other compliments. They can't handle it. But if blokes receive a compliment, there's like, they sort of melt like a slug being covered in salt. So there's no sincerity. So you can see how that would stop really a lot of conversations. And that's kind of linked to another rule, which is maybe don't go there. You know, male friendships are often built for comfort, not confession.
There's the funny bit in the book where you sort of ask your friend, you're sort of tentatively asking your friend if he wants to be involved in your wedding. And you're like, yeah, I like you. You're important to me. And, you know, he's distracted and you're watching football. And there's that. It almost reminds me of something that it also reminds me of when I'm with my friends who are parents and they're sort of distracted by the baby. But the difference is that's almost something that is understood as like it's necessity. Like, whereas football is almost like that failure to connect, but introduced as a, like, with purpose, I suppose.
Yeah. So bonding around a third thing, because it provides this distraction. And, you know, there is some quite interesting evolutionary stuff we can get into, which is kind of connected to this, but definitely that thing of not being able to talk sincerely about meaningful things or subjects with heft, emotional heft. And then another rule is like, don't be affectionate. Like, I see this all the time. And like, affection is really important in friendship because friendship's very ambiguous. Very hard to know where you are with someone on the hierarchy of their friends. Like, we kind of hard to work out. We're trying to align all the time. And most of the time we guess right. But when we're insecure about friendships, it's just like, well, I'm not sure. Are they as into me as I am into them? So the way often women get around that ambiguity is they're quite active with their affection. So they'll make sure that you understand that they like you and the experience of being with them is joyful, and it's, you feel warm and you feel the affection. With blokes, it's all under the surface. So it can increase that sense of ambiguity and be like, I don't even know this guy's my friend. Like, I reflected on a guy I'd known for 20 years on the surface, like one of my best friends, but I really had the thought like, I don't know this guy even likes me genuinely. And then of course he does, it turned out. But we've never had the conversation. I was in a pub up the road the other day and I was queuing up at the bar to get a drink. And these four women had come in, or one by one, and they'd seen each other. Like, oh, hello. Oh, wow. And they're kind of, you know, the greeting, it was so like effervescent. But then I then saw a group of blokes further into the pub who kind of, you know, a new guy came and sat down and everyone's like, Dan, like that was it. And then they sat down and they got like, oh, and then they're talking about, you know, see the game? Like it's the kind of, there's just completely different tone to things. And when that all compounds, it just makes that journey towards intimacy harder. There's just more barriers to get over. And I realized that, you know, I was guilty of all of these things. And that's why I might have people who were mates who they were like, oh, Max, good fun. If I saw him in the pub, I go and have a half with him. But I didn't have any friends, or any male friends, especially.
You use the term weekend loneliness in the book. You read an article about that and you kind of related to it. Could you explain what weekend loneliness specifically is and what, like, who does it most affect from the research that you did?
Yeah. So I think when people hear the word loneliness, it can feel quite hard to relate to, because what is loneliness? When we think of loneliness, we think of an older person. We think of someone sat on a bench who really tries to snatch conversation with you. They're clearly isolated. We think of an older person, but loneliness looks like everyone. Like, it looks of all ages, all genders. And weekend loneliness is this idea that for a lot of people, and the story I share in the book is a guy who lives in Brighton. He commutes up to London. He's got a job in London, which is, you know, pretty busy, pretty full on. And he's busy during the week with the commute. He's maybe seeing a client after work or whatever it is. he's busy with work. And but then when he kind of gets off the train in at Brighton at 7 p.m. on a Friday night, it's like, well, what now? I don't have anything to be busy with. And I'm not going to see anyone till next Monday morning when I'm 6:30 making my walk up to the station to get on the commuter train again. And I think a lot of people can connect to that, and especially a lot of older men. So obviously I do events talking about men, talking about my book, and I hear the story again and again. Oh, my husband, he doesn't got any friends. Like, he doesn't at the weekend. I'm like, please leave the house. Mm. Please give me some space so I can have some solitude. So this is, I think, it's really connected. So we talked a lot about gendering of this stuff. One reason why male loneliness is bad for women is that often their social life will revolve around the woman. If it's a straight relationship, they'll often be that guy's main emotional channel. So they have to process all of it and be that partner, that thought partner all the time. And they don't always resent it, but it's a lot. And also, do you know what? I want to have a Saturday night to myself, or I want to have a Saturday night to go out with some of my friends. And I don't want to feel like you're on the sofa being like, oh, what am I going to do? So like, that's a thing as well. So I think it's dynamic.
And did it put pressure on your relationship?
Did it put pressure on my relationship? Here's the thing. It can, for a while, make things easier. Because most couples will say, when you are single, you have your social world. And you come together, there's less time. So it's kind of helpful to share some friends, because then you get to hang out and it's not, you know, it's just efficient. And so the fact that I would hang out with her friends kind of worked, right? She didn't really mind. It's like, this is good. And I got with them, they got with me. But it's as it goes on and the person gets more isolated, that it can compound, and you think, oh, actually, I do want you to have your own group because I need some space. And also, if you think about why we find people attractive, and when you meet someone, you find them attractive, you see them doing stuff they're good at. You see them showing sides of themselves. You see them in a bar and they're telling a story and three people are leaning in going like, and you go, oh, they're rapt. Or you just see a side of people. And often when we get in a relationship, we stop being able to see that side of our partner because they're less in their context. So get in your context. You keep attractive, keep interesting. So that's important. I do remember halfway through writing the book that I went to the pub with my now wife, and I'd been doing a lot of the research, doing a lot of the work, if you like. And she said, yeah, but you're not out very much with friends. Like, you've actually got to go and do it. And I want you to do it. Like, it would mean a lot to me if you did it. And it was a kind of push I needed to be like, oh, it's not theoretical friendship. It's a practice. So that was a push that was really, really important.
And now that you've almost addressed that balance in your life and you've sort of been a bit more honest about those different forms of connection, do you think that solitude holds a different value to you? Because you kind of know that, I don't know, it's not necessarily something that you're doing is almost like a defense mechanism. It's something that you can kind of almost reappreciate for the positive reasons.
Yeah, that's a brilliant way of putting it. Absolutely. Solitude is really important to me. And I think it's connected to personality type. I'm sure you've explored this before, but there's this idea that, again, from Dunbar, like your social world, the two biggest influences on it are your sex. So there are quite profound differences in male and female social worlds, but also another influence that's very strong is personality type. So time is the number one currency for making relationships. It's kind of unavoidable. I could talk about this forever, but to keep it kind of quick, like, time is like the currency we spend. And introverts and extroverts spend that time differently. So extroverts tend to spread it over a large number of people. So there'll be a bigger social group, less time with each person. Introverts tend to heavily invest in fewer friendships and make them much deeper. And therefore, time doing the other thing can be quite draining. So like, I am actually a bit of an introvert. I don't come across it often because I can switch into showbiz me. But if I'm out, I was at a wedding on Sunday, I was absolutely wiped on Monday. And I really need that time, regain my strength and to be at my best when I'm around other people. I think you're right. Now I know that it's not just an excuse or it's not just a crutch. I can really appreciate and go, I need it. I want it. And there's nothing wrong with it at all. In fact, it's really healthy. And people do find it odd, though, don't they? People find it, people who like solitude still considered a bit odd by other people, I think. My siblings, some of my friends take the piss out of me about it. It's like, why do you want to spend so much time by yourself? Like, why? I think people still don't really get it. Like, if you're not really into spending time by yourself, people just kind of quite hard to relate, I think, still.
Probably the jokes probably don't help after you've written a book called Billy Nomades. I say as a woman who wrote a book about alone months, but yeah.
It's such an easy joke, isn't it, when you've written, like, I don't mind it. I kind of laugh it off because people often don't know what to say. So they'll often use the title of the book as like a little joke. Yeah, it could be something as simple as, you know, you knock over a drink. And it was like, oh, no wonder you're a Billy Nomades. It's like, that was good. There's an accident. Like, there's no connection. But people like always reach for the kind of the book title as the punchline to a joke.
They do. But, you know, the joke, not the joke's on them, the joke's on no one. But I think the way that you've used that humor as a Trojan horse for something that's got a really important conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Started is. I mean, don't get me wrong, you're the collateral in this.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it's again, you know, we're sort of, it's a very niche kind of weird experience, right, to have written a book about loneliness or being alone and then living with that book title. But actually, I don't know, I guess I come from the perspective of these conversations being so important that whatever way they get to you, it's just better that they're had rather than they're not.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. People's reaction is interesting, isn't it? People think I will be more uncomfortable talking about it than I am.
I know that. I know that so well.
And I'm not.
Well, good. I just want to thank you so much for, you know, for going there and being, you know, having the bravery to approach something and, you know, be a spokesman for something that's so important now. And, just, you know, thank you for everything that you do.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed it. And it's been interesting to think of the subject I've written a lot about from a completely different angle, which is solitude. And so, yeah, it's been a provocative chat.
Thanks for listening. And thank you to Max for coming on. If you'd like to discover more of Max's work, his book, Billy Nomates, is out now. And you can keep in touch with me by subscribing to my Substack newsletter on francescaspector.substack.com. This season of Alonement was edited by Pineapple Audio Productions.